invented positional calculus and invented zero. Yes, don't forget that it's Indians who introduced zero and positional calculus.
So to finish what the little time that Sasha wants to speak tonight, so there's hints in plural, and then we started, Sasha started describing Pythagorsky. It's hard to think within the Western tradition, because thought would always already be a configuration out of at least three different things. A spatial articulation, very difficult to think how a spatial articulation can go to height, and in a spatial articulation, a high degree of condensation. That was where we arrived after the sixth. Any good teacher knows you have to do when you go from the first to the second session, very end.
Thank you so much. ladies and gentlemen, think or read or speak of Buddhist philosophy of thinking, I feel as if somebody had taken the lid of my life, and I'm able to see its works, its mechanisms, but I would like now to stress that it is alive. It is life. It is not had taken the top of my skull, you know? No. And I see the workings of my brain, which I definitely not at all interested in seeing, yes? Because it is not only a far more complicated picture, which any scientific description of the workings of neuron mechanisms can give, and I know it is. I'm not at all. dismissing the great neurophysiological and biophysical discoveries of the 20th century. In connection with our mental processes, simply I'm, as it were, I'm unable to think in that way. A little digression, and after which I will return to what I left you with the day after tomorrow, yes. But again, now it is really not my own words. It is a kind of quasi-quotation from one Buddhist author of the 7th century AD. That is, when one sees the works of one's own mental mechanism, one is usually terrified. Why? For one very mighty reason. Because he sees those works as not his, as not human, as not anybody's. You know, it is, and immediately the first reaction, you know, is quite naturally that of fear. I'm sure you understand it, that what we are afraid of most of all, complete alienness. Because when we suddenly see my thinking, my warm, my hot thinking, yes, I love it, it is mine, and you see it in an absolutely schematic, objective way, in which it is not only not yours and not anybody's. It is thinking which is thought of in terms of discrete, separate emergences, and only by one chance in tens and tens of billions, it may happen in the place called I, you understand it? Or more than that, I figures here, but we'll come to it. As no more than one of the objects of your thinking. I does not exist outside that configuration. I may be one of the objects in concomitant. May or may not be, for instance. Because as you probably know, all of you, in the early Buddhist Theravadin texts, one's feeling of I is a clear mark of what? Of one's mental and intellectual underdevelopment. Because only those glib and credulous, normal, that is non-thinking in Buddhist terminology, man, see I as a kind of absolute, yes. And even that strange, as I call it, recondite Buddhist philosophy of thinking makes one prepared to rid of his own, her own, anybody's I, which is from now on ousted into that small group of concomitants, where I figures as one of the objects in the emergence of, in an emergence of thinking. Not at all necessary, not at all obligatory, a chance. Because no real Buddhist yogi thinks of himself as I. Yes, I is dismissed on the first steps of a Buddhist yogic or more, jhanic. Yoga is too misleading term. Yes, I would have said too unreal term. Jhanic, from jhana or dhyana. Yes, you know, one of the first steps is that you do not think. One. Oh, sorry, forget about that. It's very difficult. In order to think about Buddhist philosophy of thinking, Ilya, you have to permanently struggle with your own language. Be it English language, Zulu language, Papua language, yes, Russian or any other. Because, and we see it in the text, a normal human language is totally unfit for the Buddhist theory of thinking. Well, what can I do about that? Now, I would like to talk, as I already warned you, the little digression. About the background of a Buddhist philosophy of thinking. Well, as you undoubtedly know, ancient India was a homeland of the first, probably, philosophical texts of humankind. And as I had already warned you, all of them oral text in Indian context means please. Bear it in mind, not a single word was written till the middle of the first millennium BC. All traditions, and first of all, Buddhist Abhidhamic traditions, were purely oral and preserved until today. It is absolute, fantastic, unbelievable exactitude through millions and billions of oral repetitions. Because even today, I was in a couple of Buddhist monasteries. Some students repeat the Abhidhamic treatises and commentaries 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 pages per day. And their pupils, and the pupils of their pupils, and so on and so on. So the preservation of texts, yes, is absolutely impeccable, fantastic. For our ear, it sounds strange, yes? Much better than in written tradition. Okay, now I would like again to repeat that the non-Buddhist background in relation to the Buddhist philosophy of thinking or Abhidharma at that time was very, very rich. We have dozens of also oral Upanishads where some ideas were exposed which probably were not really followed but investigated in the early Buddhist ascetic tradition. Now I would like to say very shortly about the two ancient Indian ideas which might have originated at least 200 years before the first Abhidharmic text, which might have determined some essential features of the Abhidharma. The first idea, that idea you can find in any in any book of translations of the Upanishads, it is the idea of Atman. Atman, ladies and gentlemen, as you undoubtedly know, literally or etymologically is what? Oh, reflexive pronoun. Absolutely like in its reflexive function, self, in English, yes. So Atman is self in the sense of, shall we say, colloquial English, I myself do not like it, yes, or I hate myself for that, yes, etc., etc. It is a simple reflexive pronoun. Which assumed in ancient India its deepest and broadest terminological meaning, that usually it is now rendered into English as self with capital S, yes, instead of self without capital S, when in normal phrases like I myself, and it is here that we see the first delineation, I would have said demarcation, in ancient India, as far back as probably the 8th century BC, where, when, for instance, in this sentence, I myself, well, I in Sanskrit, as in the same root as in any other banal Indo-European language, yes, is aham, yes, no Greek, Latin ego, etc., 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 was separated from self-atman. Because there is I in its purely empirical function, in its banal, colloquial function, yes. For instance, I love, I hate, yes, and other. And other verbal qualification of I. While I, myself, I love, I hate, I eat, I drink, I smoke with ladies' kindest permission, sir. But myself, self is separated from I, because there appeared a very queer idea of self, which not only doesn't smoke and doesn't drink and doesn't love, but first of all, does not act. It is I am acting. Self does not act. Not only does not act, it also, and probably it is the most interesting thing, and which played a considerable role in the early formation of the first Abhidharmic texts. But the most important thing, that self-atman with long A, atman, very simple, yes, it does not think. Because in all Vedic texts, in all texts of the Vedic tradition, thinking was regarded as one of the varieties of acting. You may see in the earliest Vedic commentaries that everything is acting. Speaking is acting, acting is acting, thinking is acting. Isn't that? And in 200-300 years thereafter, we see the earliest Abhidhamic text where everything is thinking. Eating is thinking, loving is thinking, hating is thinking, acting is thinking, speaking is thinking. So it was a kind of a radical change which occurred in the interval between the 8th and the 6th centuries. By the way, it is very interesting, let me refer, but I hate all quotations, yes, yes, enough quotations, yes. But still, I cannot refrain from one quotation. You remember there was a very talented philosopher, I don't like him, who said, literally, as if he had taken it from the Vedangas of the 9th century BC, of the first learned commentaries on Vedas, Wittgenstein said, in religion, everything is acting. Speaking is acting. Worshipping is acting. Thinking is acting. That's what Wittgenstein said. As if he were repeating verbatim the lines from the earliest Vedic commentaries of the 9th century BC. So you see the main difference between those background Vedic texts and the texts of the Abhidharma. In the first, everything was acting. In the second, everything was thinking. And the very idea of Atman as of self as, ladies and gentlemen, try to remember just in case. I know, well, it's very difficult to remember everything, yes, I know, but absolutely necessary. And all the more necessary, yes. Remember, please, that it is that self which was denoted by two words. One is Atman, and the other is that. That which in Sanskrit is absolutely like in English. In English, a that, in Sanskrit, that. The same word, practically. So it is that word which became the main synonym of that self, Atman, that. So instead of saying you are Atman, they said Tatvam Asi, thou art that. Thou that art that. Absolutely the same in English and in Sanskrit, yes. What can we do? Yes, nothing. So, but still one step further, and we see the first elaborations in the early prose Upanishads. I told you that it was somewhere around 7th century BC, the first philosophical elaborations of the term Atman. What in the final analysis is Atman? What in the final analysis is that? What in the final analysis is self? And again, that which does not act, does not think, what the hell it does? Only one thing. Knows, that's it. The only function of Atman, of self, is knowledge, or more exactly, knowing. not thinking. Why not thinking? Try to think about that. In a way, very simple, because our own use, in English I mean, of the word to think or thinking implies, unfortunately, the idea of action and process. While knowing may have different connotations. For instance, knowing as not as a process, but as what?
State
and more than that. Already gotten, as a final result. In Sanskrit, jnana, is the same. Root, of course, as in English, to know, means, well, already known, that's it. If you say, I know that, it does not mean the process, I'm knowing it. I'm involved, no, it is, I got it. By the way, and very often, they were quite synonymous. I know it and I got it. So it is not a process, it is a final fact. I know it, which was attributed to self, to Atman. The only thing that Atman does, Atman knows. Or more exactly, has already known. That's it. Okay. Why is it so significant to say at least few words about Atman? For one very mighty reason, ladies and gentlemen. Atman or self was regarded as kind of spatial unit of a knowledge and consciousness, not thinking. Why spatial? Why unit? Because, according to very well known, particularly in California, yes, the most vulgar version of the theory, Indian theory of reincarnation and karma, yes. Atman is a journey from one body to another. Yes, Atman changes bodies as we see in the Bhagavad Gita. As you change your old clothes, yes, I personally hate changing my clothes, yes. Yes, and buying new clothes, which is an abomination for me. Yes, yes. Or as a bird changing its nests. So Atman changes his body, but that is, if we try to see Atman, to see Atman as that which changes, I would say consecutively, his abodes or his clothes, etc., etc. But try to look at that as it was recommended by the great masters of the Upanishad. Now, let us look at that as at this very moment. What is Atman at this very moment? It is a kind of unit of consciousness and knowledge, well, separated from other Atmans, from other units of consciousness and knowledge by what? Try to think. It's very simple. Ladies and gentlemen, yes, more active, try to be more active, yes, by Atman's nests or clothes, that is, bodies. Bodies. So it is a unit. Atman is a unit. Yes, Atman is a unit, and this circle is a body. And at this very moment, Atman can be in only one and the same body. But, ladies and gentlemen, only at this very moment. Yes?
As I said at the very beginning, if thought from last Monday was precisely the spatial articulation of Svetic Mani, I mean, don't think that in the Western tradition. You think precisely of knowledge and not having spatial articulation. So you now say the spatial articulation comes in through the necessity of being separated, because the necessity of being separated...
Not only that, I think from the necessity of being, I would have said, well, it is tantamount to what you are saying, necessity to be in a different space. Oh, you know what? I would prefer, instead of space, now, use the word place. So what is body? It is a place of one knowledge consciousness, that is one self, one Atman, yes? This is the body, yes? This is another Atman. That is another body. Body establishes spatial borders of Atman, for Atman. From which, by the way, follows that there can be no temporal characteristics when we regard two Atmans. They are merely spatial and they are observed by us now at this very moment. And more than that, ladies and gentlemen, more than that, there are billions of atoms, and atoms embodied, each of them, in one different body. They are different only because of their bodies, because as such, they are, all Atmans are absolutely the same. It is very important, you know. So, Atman is present in the early prose Upanishads as not as an entity, but as a place, limited by one body at this very given moment, as a place in which it functions, doing what? Knowing, and second, but very practically synonymous, the second function, witnessing. Knowing, observing, and witnessing, where from we have that Sanskrit term, chakshin, that is witness. Atman witnesses. What does Atman witness? First of all, it witnesses his what? Body. His body with its bodies, that body is thinking, acting, speaking, loving, hating, eating, multiplying, and other vulgar functions, yes, which I'm not going to enumerate, sir. It is of no interest. So, Atman is the witness, Chakshan, the knower and witness. And that's it, full stop. But in the Upanishads, Atman is also described as a that which witnesses its place, not only in the sense of its body, but also in the sense of what? His surrounding, his village, his city, his country, his world, his universe.
Question.
Yes?
I have a
witness.
Question. Then, should we think of Atman as being universal, or is it partial and universal? The partial part in the body is also universal.
It is, you know, your question was repeated millions of times in ancient Indian texts. Because, of course, on the one hand, Atman as such is the same. There are billions and billions of Atmans, they are the same, but still, we cannot say they are one Atman. Because at this very moment, we see one Atman in one body, or more exactly, in Sanskrit, as we see it in the first and second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, one field. Body is a field. And Atman is a master of the field. And the whole world, for any Atman is a gigantic field, the whole universe, but it is one Atman in the sense that now I am looking at, say, Ilya Green, yes, and of course I am saying to Ilya, Tattvamasi, the sacred formula of the Upanishads, Tattvam, thou art that. You but my Atman and your Atman are the same at this very moment. We may try and think up, and it was done not once in the Upanishads, of different position from the point of view of which there is one universal Atman. But still in each particular case, I'm answering you, and at each particular moment, and speaking of each particular body minor, areas, well, there are what Atmans separated by physical in this context, by physical framework of one body separated from another body, yes?
I don't know whether why does the Atman want a place? Huh? So that in this. See,
look, that
now is that question.
Because the answer is, but it is, there are quite a few, several answers, one in Karma Mimamsa, one is in Advaita Vedanta, but the classical answer is, don't be amazed, because it wants to. That's it.
That's what I was.
Because it wants to, because we see here sort of at the center of Vedic mythology, we find before Upanishads, 1,000 years before Buddhism, the idea of pristine, primordial supremacy of wish, of desire. So, because it wants the place to be witnessed by him, to be known by him, to be mastered by him. Yes, I insist here on him. Well, probably it would be more grammatically correct to say by it.
Right, and then I will shut up again for 43 minutes. So implying, which we think again within our point in the Western tradition, we'd say the answer to such a question, why does it want place, would be a functional one, an instrumental one. And say, oh, it needs a place because without a place it couldn't do this and that.
Yes.
Now, the type of answer you're giving or you're quoting, and if that's a general tendency, would say that's actually, you would say the style of answering such a question, the tendency of answering such a question, is not functionality or instrumentality, but much rather something that has to do, as you said, with desire or will.
No, it was that supremacy and priority of Icha in Sanskrit. Icha, desire. Because as we see in the Upanishads, and then it desires to think. Isn't that funny? Desires to think. So, within the framework of the Vedic Upanishadic mythology, even thinking was regarded as secondary to desire. Because you cannot think without desiring to think first. But it's very specifically Indian. So, in the Shankara commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita is written, and already written, it was written commentary, not oral, that Atman abides within its space, desiring to know it, desiring to master it, desiring to witness it. But all that simply to give you a very vague idea of what preceded the Buddhist theory of thinking, because the Buddhists, they mercilessly rejected the theory of Atman, absolutely. But So the first central idea, Atman as the unit of consciousness in space, separated from all other units by the borders of its abode, bodily abode. Yes. Now let us come to the second very interesting idea, which in some respects must have predetermined the development of the Buddhist philosophy of thinking. The second idea was that negative, that the ancient Indians, as we see it in the post-Vedic text and the Upanishads, were absolutely alien, not hostile, ladies and gentlemen, alien. It is much stronger than hostile. Alien to the idea of the absolute past. And we have to bear in mind that idea was totally alien to the Vedic world outlook. The idea of absolute past simply did not exist in the texts. Well, what does it mean? But all real things are beginningless. All real things, such as Atman, for instance, Atman is beginningless. And of course, you may say that that Atman was embodied, previously embodied in an elephant, while now, or in a dog, or while now it is embodied in the Prime Minister of Great Britain, yes. But you know, all that is vague for ancient Indian. What does it mean? Previously. Previously with respect to what? Not with respect to Atman, yes, because Atman is beginningless and endless. Atman has no history. And there can be, believe me, ladies and gentlemen, I cannot prove it. Probably Sepp will, but in my opinion, sorry, in my imagination, I have no opinions and convictions, yes, I hate all of that, yes. In my imagination, our classical idea of history is impossible without the idea, purely mythological idea, of the absolute past. And that idea was totally rejected in the Upanishads, totally rejected. Because where is the kind of point from which we can say about anything? It was, again, what is very curious, that is why in ancient India there was no, unlike ancient Egypt, unlike the whole Semitic world, unlike Sumeria, Akkad, Assyria, Babylonia, they were very negligent about their royal genealogies. That is, we have the idea that when is vulgar, because the real thing is forever and will remain itself forever, yes? As one later Indian philosopher, Vedantist, used to say, the problem of time occupies only underdeveloped minds of military chieftains, tribal headmen, and king's ministers. No real thinker would pay any attention to when. The main thing is what. So, that total dismissal of the absolute past was very typical of ancient Indian world outlook. Yes, please.
Did that negligence extend to the idea like of origins, or where?
Very often, sir. And please, as a personal favor, never use that idiotic opposition, Western-Oriental. This opposition is as thoughtless and idiotic as other modern idiocies, yes? Like the third world, the first world. All that terminology was created by great cheats of our time, yes, simply to stupefy us. In philosophy, must not be Oriental and Western. Yes, Western and Eastern. It is vulgar cliché. You understand that, yes? All of you present.
Yes and no. Because, you know, because you're speaking with so much emphasis, that's kind of, so, I mean, of course, because I felt so guilty, because in every intervention tonight I have used Western, so I probably have to say to somebody else how vulgar that is.
Except, but you know what no. In point of fact, look, because the Chinese historical world outlook was even more alien to Indian non-historical world outlook than European outlook. So all are cliches, you know. But you know, but the main thing now, Sepp, I think, one of the main obstacles to our feeble thinking now is not even a temporal cliches, but far more importantly, that those temporal cliches, well, Eastern, Western, yes, bad enough. All that ideological rubbish, yes, promoted by Edward Said and Chomsky, yes, complete rubbish, complete charlatanism, yes. I do not want to offend the feelings of those who love them, yes, yes. But you know, but even more dangerous for us now is that opposition of modern, pre-modern, post-modern, you know, that must be dismissed immediately from all normal minds, yes?
You're here.
Remember it, for heaven's sake. Now, okay. Let me return.
That it's all dismissed.
Yes, it's already dismissed. Yes. Yes.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Concerning time, isn't...
Not at all, because, you know, Mahabharata is historical from our point of view. But start with Anugita and the Bhagavad Gita, which are parts of the Mahabharata, and you will see them very clearly. Because, you know, it is very interesting, because we have some parallel ideas in Plato. For instance, when one Brahman asks another, but what about the previous generations of our great ancestors, yes, our forefathers? And then another Brahman says, look, yes, but it is normal people, otherwise they won't be able to read it. It is for normal, that is, non-thinking people. Normal people are non-thinking people, you know that. So it was a kind of, and more than that, they worked out, like Plato, their own idea of myth, mythology, itihasa in Sanskrit. Mythology, which is for normal people, yes. They cannot do without ideology, without ancestors, without the beginning, without the end of the world, yes. Without it's for normal people to make them happy, yes.
The opiate of the people.
Sorry?
The opiate of the people.
Sorry?
The opiate of the people.
Well, nobody rather to make their life comfortable. It's very interesting. And that is why, in the first place, in the philosophical part of the Mahabharata, the complete denial of temporality. It is so interesting. While that the whole epic is, of course, temporal, to be told. And that you know that its origins are purely bardic.
So you think it consists of two parts?
Probably even of
like
three parts. Or shall we say better, three levels. And it is very clearly seen, the highest level of the absolute knowledge. For instance, the level of Krishna, the Lord, in the Bhagavad Gita. then the middle level of those who know the truth but not the absolute truth. The one and the lowest level is for normal people, mainly for warriors, for kings, yes, for kings, for learned Brahmins, for scholars, they are normal people. And the lowest level is for normal, as we see in the seventh part of the Mahabharata, let me quote it. For normal bandits, womanizers, and executioners.
How about butchers?
Sorry?
Butchers.
Well, you, no, butchers, it is too terrible even to mention. Yes, because they were considered untouchables. Now, so, the Abhidharma borrowed from the very start the idea of no absolute past. And it was very important. It became one of the most important Buddhist teachings. He may concoct history, yes. To make you and ourselves happy, yes. But we know that each and every level of thinking or consciousness must have its own time, ladies and gentlemen. While the idea of absolute past establishes a kind of artificial, not even historical time. It implies a section of history where the absolute past is a kind of foundation. But in fact, there are two foundations. The unilinearity of time and the absolute past.
The thinking is going, but what would be a generalized ecstatic, as Heidegger would have said, or structure of time is local. There's no, an absolute past would be the individuality of
it. Not only beyond the singularity, first of all. Singularity of the event or emergence of thought, and then, of course, beyond. I think that idea influenced Abhidharma very much, because there was a very heated discussion somewhere in the 2nd century AD in the Sautrantika school about the time, and then they agreed on a kind of temporary, speaking of time, they agreed as a kind of truth, yes, temporary compromise. That, of course, the past is far less real than the present. It was a sort of compromise. While in the Prajnaparamita school, more Abhidharmic than Sautrantika, it was formulated in a far more revolutionary way. The past is reproduced from the temporal material of the present moment. It is one of the artificial illusions of the present moment. Whereas the future, again, is very interesting. The future was regarded in Virginia Nevada Yogacara school as the kind of secondary function, as something secondary to and derivative from the wrong idea of the existence of the pastime. So we may say that the past was regarded as secondary, but the future was regarded as a secondary from the secondary, or as illusion, maya, illusions of the second degree. Yes. Now, well, it is enough, because, you know, unfortunately, we are living in this idiotic time, yes? Yes?
So there is one problem in my mind. There is a...
Your name is...
Aviv.
Sorry?
Aviv.
Aviv?
Yes.
That is father?
No, this is spring.
Ah, yes.
Different spelling.
Different spelling, yes. My dear Aviv, that difference was established in the Abhidharma from the earliest texts. It was absolutely crucial. Why? Because the only, I'm terribly sorry, gentlemen, but it is not I who invented all that stuff with your kindest permission. It is not my responsibility, it is my love. I love it, but I'm not responsible. My impression is, Sonia, that responsibility kills love. Yes. I love the Abhidharma, but I'm... you agree with me? Yes, too much responsibility, no. But I'm answering you with absolute yes. Because time was considered as... time was considered as artificial, it is a play of our own mind. As illusion or illusion, while space was considered absolute.
Is this why there is a need for the boundary of the atom?
In a way, yes, but particularly in Buddhism, where there are only two unconditioned dharmas, absolute dharmas, only two, nirvana and space. All the rest is conditioned. So your question was very timely. Now,
may I make an offer, because I know what it means when you look as...
Yes, outside here, absolutely.
Yeah, and as time can be disregarded, actually, because we have now seen that time is not all that important, we would love to...
So I'll go for 2 minutes outside. outside, yes, 2 minutes, 2 present minutes.
Yes.
I stress it, present, which, by the way, according to Abhidharma, are not yet present.
But you make them present.
I will try my best to make them present.
And
yes.
We reconvene in 5 precious minutes.
Yeah.
Okay. But wait 1 second.
Right now. Nothing to drink. Sorry? What? Who's right?
Well, with drink.